Welcome. I am Clifton Jolly, and I am chairing this session.
Do you want to have it on?
No, they don't need me on that. And the reason I'm chairing this session is because Gene asked me to. And Gene and I have known each other for, I guess, about 30 years, haven't we?
Since 78.
Seems impossible.
We met at
More
Gene
than...
England's house.
Yeah?
At Christmas, 78.
78, oh my. I was 9 at the time. Eugene, you are 78, aren't you, Eugene?
Yes, I am, 78. 78, going on. So you got to get Paul in here. He's out there preaching.
Okay.
And he should be in here.
Paul, Eugene wants you in here.
Agent Paul.
Eugene Kovalenko is the only one who can order Paul Toscano around.
Are you chairing?
Are we starting?
We're starting, Paul. Just all these old people all of a sudden. And Eugene is very old. Welcome, Paul.
I'm sorry I'm late.
That's all right. The reason we like Paul Toscano here is because as long as Paul is in the room, we are not the most outrageous people in the country.
That's true.
So I met Eugene at Eugene England's house, and he was the most remarkable chap because what I remember most about him at the time was his beautiful singing voice. And whatever we have to hear from him today will not be as enlightening as if he were sing to us. And I also got the sense that he was working for the government on projects that he couldn't talk about. At Los Alamos, New Mexico. And if I were to describe to you the crescendo of his professional and personal life, he would have no time for his presentation. So I will simply tell you that I regard him to be a wonderful singer. He has a great beard. He is a scientist. He is a protester against nuclear arms and development. He wheedled me into joining one of his organizations based upon the single argument that until we know how to get rid of the stuff, we shouldn't make any more of it. Seemed logical to me. And he now drives a school bus where I'm absolutely certain he is infecting the children of the next generation with his outrageous revolutionary opinions, among which he is going to talk about today, which is the failure of the Mormon Church and its people to stand up against the nuclear threat. I give you Eugene Kovalenko.
I can take my prop off, can I?
Yes.
So, well, you've read the abstract, or you put the slides 2 and 3 on it. So the Los Alamos National Laboratory, created by the Manhattan Project during World War II, is famously and infamously known as the birthplace of the atomic bomb. It is considered by many as the original source of the corruption of science and many world governments. It is notably also Mormon-friendly, with a large Mormon population in 2 wards. Many laboratory and community leaders of good intent in Los Alamos are unaware or in denial of this corruption. This paper describes this corruption, Mormon and American Indian influences at the laboratory, and the surrounding community, and suggests an effective way that Mormons in any community can set an example of deep awareness and transformation. So I begin the slide four now. Something's gone wrong.
Nothing's gone wrong, Gene. Just proceed.
Well, I want you to have this picture of my cousin.
You'll have it there any moment. I'm moving a little slower than I was. All right, here we go.
What I've just read is in the program, so nothing's missing yet. Slide four.
It's a Mac. It has to think for a moment.
What's that about the Indians? That's not in here.
It isn't in there? It's in the title. So, I begin now with an unapologetic boast about my late, legendary Del Clausen.
What's a shaman?
A shaman. You don't know what a shaman is? We'll tell you about that later.
Okay.
They call him a living prophet.
There are things many more offensive in his speech than the shaman.
So I have an unapologetic boast about the late legendary Del Clausen, a conservative California Republican congressman, a Mormon, and my second cousin. His father and my mother's father were brothers, and I have fond memories of meeting Cousin Del long before he began his political career in Compton, California, where he served as a popular mayor for 7 years in the 50s, during which he was elected to the House of Representatives and served another 14 years in the 60s and 70s before retiring undefeated from public life. In early years, he also served as a Mormon bishop. The congressional district he represented was heavily Democratic, and most of his constituents were black. He liked claiming to be a George Romney Republican with a Barry Goldwater attitude. He also was a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee, the infamous HUAC. To my mind, Del Clausen represents the ideal Mormon politician, well before the historic 1978 change of Mormon policy on priesthood, which finally included blacks. I will show how Clausen's brand of Mormonism and political power can be put to use by Mormons everywhere to transform local, state, and national governance. Now, slide five. You got it. Good. Very important word in the Russian Orthodox tradition. I want now to make you aware of a word in the Orthodox tradition of my father that I have embraced since the last time I presented here at Sunstone in 2008. It is the most important word I have learned in the past 4 years. When I learned this word in 2009, I felt convicted, pained, and also liberated. It is a Russian word for which there is no good equivalent in English. The closest are pride, hubris, or spiritual conceit, with a special twist. The word is prelest, as it is used in the 1922 writings of legendary Russian Orthodox priest Pavel Florensky. Slide six. Pavel Florensky was called by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, called flock father, or prince, or priest father, Father Florensky, one of the most remarkable men devoured by the Soviet gulags of all time. And quoting Florensky, he said in this book about Prelest, whereas an ordinary sinner knows he is falling away from God, the soul in Prelest thinks he is drawing ever closer to him, God, and while angering him, thinks he is gladdening him. For those of you who are familiar with Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, the Russian translation of Gollum's precious, the highest ring of power, is the word prelest. Please keep that word in mind in this essay. I try to keep it in mind daily, wondering how many there are of us who identify with Frodo, the ring bearer in the Lord of the Rings, as I sometimes do. Number 7. Where discoveries are made. As you approach the little town of Los Alamos, New Mexico, where my wife Brigitte and I have lived all our married life for almost 19 years, you will see on the screen this motto carved on stone monikers on both sides of the road. A few minutes drive later, slides 8 and 9, you will see a series of small blue banners positioned on downtown light posts along Central Avenue. The motto, where discoveries are made. Leaders of the Los Alamos County Government and Chamber of Commerce are fond of promoting the motto, where discoveries are made. It does not refer to the controversial legacy of the Manhattan Project, which many, including myself, refer to as bomb power. Can you see how the word prelest might apply here? So there's an integrity gap. In addressing the word corruption, which appears 3 times in my abstract, I want to refer to it in terms of the gap between the idealistic motto of where discoveries are made and the historical reality of bomb power, this being the reality, this being the principle or the concept. So there's a big gap. If integrity can be defined in terms of the gap between principle and behavior, then the smaller the gap between principle and behavior, the higher the integrity of an individual or a group. This is also a measure of authenticity. It seems to me that there is a large integrity gap in the community of Los Alamos, let alone in most other communities. And I believe that this integrity gap would diminish significantly, if not completely, if the above motto implicitly included the word spiritual, where spiritual discoveries are made. This is where indigenous American and Mormon factors enter the equation, which I hope to make clear in this paper. In trying to get enough sanity, the tendency for my own prelest to address the theme of this symposium, mainly Mormons and Mormonism as a political force, I reflected on writings that have profoundly affected me in the last several years. First, in his classic 1987 book, The Different Drum, the late Christian psychiatrist M. Scott Peck describes 4 stages of community, beginning with stage 1, pseudo-community, then to stage 2, chaos. And beyond that to stage 3, emptying.
All of us here.
And to stage 4, if we can survive, true community, where everyone is welcome. Second, in physicist psychologist Arnold Mindell's The Deep Democracy of Open Forums, Mindell presents ways to navigate Peck's 4 stages of community to achieve deeper community awareness. In summer 1988, I had just read The Different Drum and proudly introduced myself to M. Scott Peck as a practicing Mormon shortly after he delivered an invited speech to the 1988 US-USSR Sister Cities Conference in Telluride, Colorado. His first question... That wasn't... question. His first question to me after my presumptuous and pretentious announcement was, "Do you know the Sunstone Foundation in Salt Lake City?" I did not. He then expressed his belief that Sunstone was an ideal example of stage 3 community, or emptying, and that the establishment Mormon Church in Salt Lake City was an excellent example of stage one, or pseudo-community. When I expressed puzzlement at this comment, Peck further explained that he was aware that some high-level Mormon leaders who may privately experience stage four community were concerned that Sunstone participants would forever be stuck in stage three. Again, can you see how pre-list might fit here? Next, nuclear waste management at LANL, the Los Alamos National Laboratory. And I'll refer to it as LANL, it's easier to say. In May 1993, I was invited by the Los Alamos National Laboratory's nuclear waste management people to help them better communicate with local groups of anti-nuclear activists who were trying to shut down the lab. I was then living in Santa Fe, and they had learned from a Mormon friend about my professional experience as a nuclear materials research scientist in the middle 60s, as a leader of the US-USSR liaison company in the middle 70s, and as an engineering manager in aerospace industry in the late 1980s. I did not disclose my clandestine military experience in the mid-50s. They felt I could help these activists better understand LANL's position and purpose because of my then anti-nuclear attitude, in contrast to my former nuclear materials research experience. I don't want to be your salesman, I insisted. That is not what we are asking, they replied. We think you can better understand both sides of the issue and help us better communicate. And so we struck a deal. It did not last long. My anti-nuclear activist friends soon stopped talking to me, believing I had been co-opted and sold out. A short while later, and unknown to me at the time, I learned of a dirty tricks campaign to paint me as a spy for the anti-nukes by anonymous sources, ostensibly from outside the laboratory, which I learned later actually came from within the laboratory. This hit the headlines of the local newspaper in late 1993 while I was out of the country with my new Swedish wife visiting her family for the holidays. Can all of you hear me okay? On returning to the country, I learned that my participation with the nuclear waste people had become compromised and soon found myself transferred to the Director's Stakeholder Involvement Office, SIO, in an apparent attempt to neutralize me. Soon, I was abruptly terminated for budgetary considerations. Again, can you see how the word pre-list applies here? Fortunately for me, a new Christian friend who headed up a lab group charged with nuclear safety and who knew my background sought my technical liaison and management experience to organize a seminar between Russian and American nuclear scientists and engineers to assess an incident that had taken place in Siberia in 1993 where a plutonium reprocessing plant had exploded, scattered plutonium all over the countryside. It wasn't a bomb, it was just a reprocessing, but you have the plutonium all over. And Lawrence will know what that means back there, having worked at the Nevada test site. Yeah. So at the end of that satisfying experience, that satisfying assignment in 1995, my contract with the laboratory expired, and I was again out of a job. But I stuck around the Los Alamos community, believing I had come there for good reason and that there was yet something meaningful to do, and that is the purpose of this paper. It's taken this long to get to the point where maybe I could do something meaningful. The Los Alamos Deep Democracy Open Forum, slide left. In March 2010, having just read physicist, psychologist Arnold Mandel's Deep Democracy and Open Forums, I serendipitously viewed a Charlie Rose PBS interview with historian Gary Wills about his newest book, Bomb Power, A Rigorous New History of the Manhattan Project, using newly declassified information. Before you get to slide 12, let me just say something about Arnie Mandel. He's an old friend from the 1960s. took a physics degree from MIT and then became a Jungian analyst at the Jung Institute in Zurich. And he then developed a whole new process work psychology, and he's now based in Portland, Oregon. And Wills is a favorite guest of Charlie Rose. He's an emeritus history professor from Northwestern and a Jesuit-trained theologian. These two events flash fused in my mind the idea of a Los Alamos deep democracy open forum. You're too far away. It's all right. And I emailed longtime physicist psychologist friend Mindell wondering about its feasibility. Did he see the global implications of what Los Alamos represented internationally? He did. And hours later, he replied, "Lay the groundwork, we will support you." With that encouragement, I formed a pilot discussion group. The first person I called was Jim Bradbury, son of Norris Bradbury, the successor to the legendary and controversial first laboratory director, Robert Oppenheimer. Jim and I had worked together in 1994 in the Stakeholder Involvement Office under LANL Deputy Director Jim Jackson, a prominent Mormon. Bradbury subsequently talked to Gary Wills about the idea, since Wills mentions the significant influence of Jim's father at the lab as the lab's second director. Our initial plan was to bring Mindell and Wills to Los Alamos for an internationally promoted first Los Alamos Deep Democracy Open Forum. And you will remember my contacting you about this.
I do. And your unwillingness to let me say no.
Wills expressed interest and asked to be kept informed. The next people contacted were a married couple recently relocated to Santa Fe near Los Alamos from Portland, Oregon, where they had been longtime colleagues of Mindell. Both were thoroughly familiar with facilitating deep democracy forums. The fifth person was my wife, Brigitte. At the end of our first meeting, the five of us, I asked everyone to make note of their dreams from then on, since the deep democracy concept highlights dreaming as an essential element of the process. This couple was well experienced with dream work. So were my wife and I. However, Jim, who rarely remembers his dreams, had a dream that very night. His dream was so relevant that it has led to our first project, which involves the local American Indian tribe in the San Ildefonso Pueblo, whose land the Manhattan Project took over in the early 1940s. Does Preless describe this behavior? After Jim's dream began to evolve, it morphed into a project that we now call the Story Trees of Los Alamos, where Pueblo shamanic artists are to be commissioned to express their stories of the Manhattan Project takeover, a theme that runs deep in the collective psyche of the Pueblo's indigenous people who have been on this land for centuries and who still today feel the violation of our government's takeover. In their grand vision, the laboratory and the surrounding Anglo-dominated community is but a passing phenomenon, a mere 70-year encampment viewed from a centuries-old tradition and civilization. Bomb power, again. The cover of Gary Wills' book succinctly describes the asserted corruption of the Manhattan Project. Quoting Wills, "The invention of the atomic bomb was a triumph of official secrecy and military discipline. The project was covertly funded at the behest of the President, Roosevelt, and despite its massive scale, never discovered by Congress or the press. This concealment was perhaps to be expected in wartime, but Wills persuasively argues that the Manhattan Project then became a model for the covert operations and overt authority that have defined American government in the nuclear era. The wartime emergency put in place during World War II extended into the Cold War and finally the War on Terror. leading us in a state of continuous war alert for 68 years and counting. Now the Los Alamos Study Group, slide 13. The Los Alamos Study Group, was the first anti-nuclear group I met with in August 1993 after contracting to help the lab communicate better with local activists. Less than 5 months into the project, I learned from the leader of LASG that my liaison activities between LANL and the activist groups were doomed. This leader disclosed, because he had inside information, this leader disclosed then that his personal motivation was spiritual, quote, quote, he being a Buddhist, and that he was using this activity to grow spiritually, his challenge of LANL. But he dared not explicitly mention the word spiritual in public, fearing a loss of financing and credibility. He was still of this opinion 17 years later in December 2010 when he declined LADOF, that's my company, LADOF's invitation to join our board of advisors, which overtly acknowledges the spiritual aspect of deep democracy. He wrote, quote, "I'm up to my eyeballs in critical work here. Perhaps we can say it is work of a spiritual nature, if you will, or at least not yet fully sincere approximation to it. We usually must wash our mouths out with soap if we use that kind of language, spiritual, or anything like it, and wash our wallets when we hear it." Unquote. I hope we can talk of spiritual discoveries in this town, Los Alamos, without worrying about our wallets or washing our mouths out with soap, or without getting into debates about religious ideology. Slide 14. Concerned citizens for nuclear safety. Another local anti-nuclear activist group, CCNS, would like to transform the mission of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, which we at LADOF would applaud and acknowledge and encourage. Here's their mission statement. The mission of the Los Alamos National Laboratory must be diversified in order to create a new security for our country and the world. This new mission would transfer funding and expertise away from nuclear and non-nuclear weapons design, development and production, and into cleanup, non-proliferation, emergency management, and preparedness and basic sciences. Unquote. Other examples of corrupting and contaminating legacy of the Manhattan Project are too numerous to list. We could start with horrendous problems like the huge, decades-long leaking tanks of nuclear waste at the Hanford Nuclear Laboratory near Seattle, like the nuclear waste site of Rocky Flats in Colorado, like the accidentally lost nuclear bombs from U.S. Air Force bombers flying over Spain, like the Fukushima and Chernobyl catastrophes, to say nothing of the nuclear programs and ambitions of Israel, North Korea, Iran, Pakistan, India, and all the other countries and groups continually seeking the bomb to gain power and dominance. The Native American factor. Because Mormons believe the Book of Mormon was ostensibly written to the descendants of the Lamanites, which they have historically considered to be the American Indians, they have a major stake in working with tribal nations. Beginning with Joseph Smith, the Mormon Church has sought to proselyte and assimilate the Indians as a way to help them improve their lives. Problematically, the church's policy has changed over the years in reaction to Mormon attempts to convert rather than understand and respect the traditions of centuries-old aboriginals. How might pre-list apply here? Slide 16. Only this past year have I become aware of the great law of peace of the Iroquois Confederation of Nations as having had major impact on the thinking of our founding fathers, such as Franklin, Jefferson, and Madison, in structuring the U.S. Constitution. Instead of trying to convert and assimilate descendants of these traditions, Mormons ought to be partnering with Aboriginal shamans in their roles as living prophets, in developing strategies to transform corruption and contamination policies into creative ways for solving our nation's problems. This attitude requires a new way of thinking and approaching Native American people who have suffered egregious losses since the founding of our nation. Instead of dictating our views to them, we ought to be listening and honoring their visionary past and present. Aboriginal Americans have experienced terrible losses in morale and hope, largely because of inconsistent or unfair U.S. government policies and ineptness.
Ineptness.
Mormons can help reverse or change these policies and practices if they can transform their own sense of superiority and exclusiveness and learn to appreciate the truths of others, especially those who have been excommunicated, ignored, dismissed, or marginalized.
What a fraternity.
Again, the word prelist.
How is it that if you're not excommunicated, you feel left out? I mean, what is this?
Slide 17. The Los
Even
Alamos.
Us all together, though.
Yeah, there.
That's my soul brother back there. Los Alamos, as a matter of fact, it was because of my excommunication in 92 that you guys got yourselves in trouble. In 93.
Possibly. I thought that they thought we had done it all on our own.
They were looking for an excuse.
There were so many reasons that Paul and Margaret got in trouble. I mean, it's hard to do this.
That's right. I'm sorry. They had gotten in trouble all by themselves.
I once made the point that Paul should have been excommunicated just for being disagreeable. Margaret should have been left alone.
That's right. Well,
I certainly concur with that.
Yes. The Los Alamos has a sister city. Los Alamos has a sister city program with its Russian counterpart in the closed nuclear city of Sarov, not far from Moscow. Sarov officials initiated this project in the early 1990s, shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union, in typical Soviet style, by contacting the highest local government official in Los Alamos and establishing a personal relationship. Providentially, this man, then chairman of the Los Alamos County Council, was an active Mormon and a missionary representative of his ward. Mm-hmm. Also, in typical Soviet style, once that kind of relationship is established, ex-Soviet Russians do not like to change horses in midstream, which means this Mormon man is still at the helm of the city, sister city project, even though he is old, he's in his middle 80s now, and retired from both politics and his position with the laboratory. He was a particle physicist. And we knew each other, unknown to each other, in 1954 in Monterey, California. This project is now exchanging groups of citizens visiting each other in our homes, which includes young people from the local San Ildefonso Pueblo. This initiative is growing. Slide 18. And another initiative is our Ladoff project, which you're seeing now, of commissioning tribal artists to reach into their traditions and tell their stories through art. This initiative is slow growing at present because of intra-tribal conflicts, which we do not yet understand well enough. We at Ladoff have more trust building to do, hopefully with Mormon cooperation. Personal examples. I want now to get personal with a few memories that came to mind when informed of the theme of this symposium. I was very excited by seeing it. For me, it clearly began when I learned a song as a boy in the 1940s that goes like, a Mormon boy, I am a Mormon boy, I might be envied by a king, for I am a Mormon boy. How many of you remember that song? If so, did it affect
too
you?
Too many of us.
Did it affect you with a sense of pride and specialness as it did me? I loved that song. Between those childhood days in the mid-40s, clandestine military days in the mid-50s, and nuclear materials research in the mid-60s, I became preoccupied with Soviet Cold War offensive intentions. In the midst of this preoccupation, I presented an unusual military defense proposal to Professor J.B. Ryan at Duke University, who is considered by many as the father of parapsychology, is his word, extrasensory perception, ESP, who immediately invited me to join his new foundation for research on the nature of man. Slide 19 now. In the midst of this initiative, at his invitation, and despite my focus on military defense, I had a pivotal dream. On December 23rd, 1964, that's Joseph Smith's birth date, which began to redirect my preoccupation with the Soviet threat to the awareness of conflicts and contradictions in my own Mormon backyard. In consequence of a spiritual awakening in 1965, my life suddenly changed direction, and I soon found myself out of the Mormon Church and ironically into the Soviet Union during the detente period of the Cold War in the mid-1970s. During that tenure, I went to Moscow 5 times in 10 months, and during my first trip, wrote a letter to the Soviet Ministry of Foreign Trade, which I have often wondered may have softened general Soviet attitudes toward the Mormon Church. Ironically, again, I later realized that I was unconsciously on an individual Mormon mission to Moscow, despite being an excommunicant. Slide 20. Now, this is a map of my map, but I won't say much about it. It's a map of my journey from those days of 64 I just told you about, going into excommunicated process, and then going to the Soviet Union, and then on to 92. So that's just a brief map that goes along with another presentation I gave to the Relief Society in 1992, at their invitation, incidentally. That was before I was excommunicated for the second time. You have to be really dedicated to be excommunicated twice.
No, you just have to keep your dreams to yourself.
In 1975, after my Northwest Soviet Liaison Corporation collapsed the previous year due to my inability to anticipate and cope with a Mormon client defaulting on an agreement, I felt prompted to rejoin the Mormon Church in order to find out why I had allowed myself to be blindsided. There seemed to be unfinished business to attend to. This so-called unfinished business would eventually lead to my understanding the word prelest. In 1989, having returned to the church in summer 75, I presented my first paper to a Sunstone symposium entitled Mormon Mission to Moscow, which describes a US-USSR sister cities event in Kiev during the 1988 millennial celebration of the conversion of the Russian Empire to Christianity. In 1992, my Sunstone paper of 1990, The Values Crisis, precipitated a second excommunication after I had raised my hand in a state conference opposing the far-right conservative leadership of then LDS Church President Ezra Taft Benson. That's when my friend here called me. He had called me the second most naive person in his acquaintance, and I asked him about the first, and he said that was Eugene England. And then when I told him this story, he says, "You have now become the first." Yes, indeed.
You've been excommunicated only twice.
Only twice.
I had assumed three.
That's coming.
He tells them over and over again. Confused.
Maybe it has been 3 years.
I just gave you the chart. I'm sorry.
Sorry, yeah. Sorry.
No one relishes their excommunication
as much as Gene.
Well, it was the second one was liberating and a marvelous experience. It was amazing, and I got a chance this time because the other one was done in absentia, in closed doors, behind the scenes, and that was hugely destructive to me and my family. This time I got a chance to stand in my own defense. 6-hour KGB-like interrogation by the state president, who was also the Ventura County deputy sheriff, and he was interrogating a criminal, and he couldn't break my spirit, and I left on top of cloud nine. He was not successful.
You're going to go for 3, aren't you?
Well, I'll tell you, you'll know at the end of this paper, you'll know that isn't going to be necessary.
Okay.
Because the Lord doesn't recognize those 2 excommunications. Anyway. Where did I go?
Where Los Alamos Ward is your next slide.
I raised my arm in protest. This was in protest of an official attitude of intimidation of the Mormon intellectual community, such as Dialogue and Sunstone, which I could not sustain in good conscience. Even though I was aware of remarkable behavioral parallels between Soviet and Mormon ways of making decisions, the Mormon Church was not really like the Soviet Union, or so I thought. Is this not another example of pre-list? My last example can be illustrated by referring to a series of 4 personal dreams from March to August 2010, which began with LADOF director Jim Bradbury's first dream in March of 2010, which I've already told you about, and that has led to this project with the Indians. And it contains the next 3 were my own dreams. And I want only to share my 3rd dream with you, except the first one had my mother coming to visit me, and my late mother came to visit me, and I told her about my Los Alamos Deep Democracy Open Forum. Are you interested? And she said, well, of course I'm interested. Now, she had never been interested in my idea before. She died. But now, and she says, but then, I suggest you run it by Del Clausen's people. That's where I got the idea of Del Clausen. And I've done that.
You have about 13 minutes remaining.
That's all I've got?
I apologize.
Oh, golly.
It's just depending on how many dreams you had yet to tell.
No, there's more. No more dreams, but I do.
I want to cut a few out.
Thank you. I'm going to read you my dream. An interview of a dream of the 3rd dream, and here's the dream. I'm in the Los Alamos Ward of the Mormon Church. It looks exactly like that. Can you find that? That's it, right there. I'm in that ward. I'm with the bishop, exactly the man. We're not in his office, which is where I've met him twice before. On a one-on-one real life, but we're sitting in the building corridor. There's lots of people moving around as we pass, as we talk, and one is a very large, aging hippie-like woman, with a long blonde braid hanging down her back. I say to her, "I think you were a hippie in earlier years," and I hear everybody laugh. I have a message for the bishop, which is that the 2 excommunications I have experienced by the Mormon Church were examples of unrighteous dominion, and that therefore the Lord does not recognize them. Remember, this is a dream. I'm not making this up. This is a dream. I am using church legal language to attempt to arrange a meeting on the matter with the local high council. My message is not only to see if the church hierarchy will not only acknowledge this unrighteous dominion behavior, but also extend that acknowledgement so as to set an example of transformation for the larger community of Los Alamos, the site of the creation of the atomic bomb. And if this can be done, the Los Alamos community might learn to transform its awesome, world-changing legacy to set a new example for the international world in general, an acknowledgement and transformation of Prelest. Continuing the dream, I cannot tell if the bishop understands my message because he continues to be interrupted by others as we talk. He looks at a man down the hall with a vacuum cleaner who is cleaning up after a church celebration and nods approval at the job of cleaning up. So Joseph asked this question. Joseph Dillard, who interviewed me on this dream, he says, how do you get heard by those who value doctrine over love or justice? How do you do drama without getting caught in the drama triangle, avoiding the roles of victim, rescuer, or persecutor? And he says, and he continues, in this interview, Eugene chose to interview a non-human dream character that normally would supply useful objective, the building. Therefore, another character, but the building, because the church, it was a church building, it was soon found to be exclusivist and beyond reproach. Therefore, another character needed to be interviewed, but which one? It is interesting that while the church building was itself biased and closed-minded, it was able and willing to recommend a character that was transformative for this dreamer, a large, aging, former hippie woman with a long, blonde braid. And after asking what fundamental issues I was up to, he asked, why do you think you had this dream? And I say, I have a project I'm working on in Los Alamos called the Deep Democracy, the Los Alamos Deep Democracy Open Forum. If it were playing in a theater, what would be on the marquee? The spiritual transformation of Los Alamos. What are the characters? The Mormon Ward House. LDS bishop, hippie woman, vacuum man, rug, debris on rug, people milling about, Los Alamos community, and the bomb. Ward House. He now addresses, and I'm going to pretend I've become the Ward House. I become in the dream, as you can do with all the characters in your dreams, you can become them and interview them, you can talk to them. And that's what he's doing with me. Ward House, would you please tell me about yourself, what you are doing?
I have been built with the finest materials by inspired people to exact dimensions. I am very secure and well-financed. In me is the truth.
What do you like most about yourself and your strengths? Joe continues.
Security, solidity, clarity, absoluteness, confidence.
And what do you dislike about yourself most? Do you have weaknesses? What are they?
There is absolutely nothing I don't like about myself. I have no weaknesses.
Ward House, you are in Eugene's dream, right? He created you, right?
Yes, and yes.
What aspect of Eugene do you represent or most closely personify?
I am his sense of very rigid clarity.
Laugh over there, young man. Ward House, it doesn't sound like you're going to be able to give us much of a different perspective. Do you have a recommendation of someone else, another character, that might be helpful? The hippie woman. Hippie woman. Would you please tell me about yourself and what you're doing? I'm so pleased that you ask. No one asks me much of anything because I'm so big. In this place, no one wants to think about wild people. I have a very wild past that I love. They don't like to hear about it because it scares them. I love these people, and that's why I'm here. I understand their fears, and I've been waiting for this interview for a long time. I love people. I accept people for who and how they are, without condemnation, with compassion, and that includes their fears. There was a time when I didn't like myself. At this time, I am so pleased with myself. I am grateful for being here, that I am this large. I am grateful that I see what I couldn't see before. I see the fear and the rigidness and the arrogance and the blindness, and it's okay. But that's where the problem is. hippie woman. You're Eugene's dream, correct? He created you, right?
Yes,
and yes. What aspect of Eugene do you represent most closely, personify? His love for his people, his family, his friends, his love for those who hate him and fear him. He is feeling deep desire that they know of his love and caring, but they don't know this, and they don't know that they don't know that they don't know. He is expressing his gratitude for my being in his life among them. I have taken such a strong place. Hippie woman, if you could be anywhere you wanted to be and take any form you desired, would you change? If so, how? No, I am where I need to be. I am so moved that you have asked and that there are those who care. Do you feel that Eugene is hearing you? I am so happy, yes, to be truly heard. Hippie woman, how would you score yourself 0 to 10 in confidence, compassion, wisdom, acceptance, peace of mind, and witnessing? And why? Confidence, 10. I know who I am, warts and all. Compassion, 10. I have been through a lot. I have learned to be compassionate. It's not been easy. Wisdom, 10. I can't imagine it being less than 10. When I think of wisdom, I think of meaning. I think of seeing the connectedness of all creatures and images. I think of the meaning of trees, the ocean, the sky. It makes me smile. They are what they are. They all have a place. I celebrate that place. Acceptance, 10. We are who we are. I love it. Inner peace, 10. I can't think of anything less. Witnessing, 10. I see, thank God, a grandeur of being, a grandeur of beauty, of experience, a grandeur of even blindness and rigidity. It all has its place in life. How would Eugene's life be different if he naturally scored like you in all 6 of these qualities all the time? He wouldn't need to react to anyone. He reacts a lot now. He reacts a lot to the ward house, to the leadership that produced, inhabits, and claims that building. He's still in reaction to a lot of that and demanding. If he were like me, he wouldn't need to be that demanding. Well, how would that change his life? He would probably disidentify with that part of himself that is standing on top of a wall crying repentance. He would be joking, loving, accepting. He would just be there, wherever he was, understanding, without demands, patient. If you could live his life, would you live it differently? With more patience, compassion, without demands, with humor. What 3 life issues would you focus on if you were in charge of Eugene's life? The open forum is what I'm here for, to give him a different perspective. He is challenging but not demanding of this new Mormon leadership to bring him in front of the High Council and present to them an idea that seems timely, that this place of Los Alamos has an opportunity to take advantage of. This gives him a new approach that he hasn't considered before. In what situations would it be beneficial for Eugene to imagine that he is you and act as you would? In virtually all life situations. That's the personality he needs to carry with him in all outer life situations. Hippie woman, do you do drama? If not, why not? Yes, I do drama with pleasure, without anxiety, without worry. It's fun, it brings color, it brings humor, it brings life. I can't imagine life without drama. It would be silly. Do you play the victim? I can play it, but I'm not it. Do you play the rescuer? I can do that too, with great fake self-righteousness. Do you do the persecutor? I can do it very well. There is a Hitler-like character in me, a small potatoes. What is your secret for staying out of drama? Detachment. I can easily detach. Why do you think you're in Eugene's dream? He needs me. He has forgotten me. I am here for him. He now sees me. That's why I am so big. He has avoided seeing me before. How am I doing?
Got about 3 minutes left.
Oh, okay, we're going to do it. How is Eugene most likely to ignore what you are saying to him? If he were a fool, he would ignore me. He doesn't want to be a fool. Actually, he is a fool. And he has been very proud of it before. Maybe he's not so proud of it now. Hippie woman, what would you recommend that he do about that? Remember the long blonde braid. Hippie woman, why do you think Eugene had this dream? To get him focused at a new reference point, a new view of what he can bring to the table in his conversations with the Mormon community. It means embracing a sense of humanity to him that he hasn't been conscious of before, that he hasn't allowed himself to be aware of, that he's been too proud of before to be aware of. That is, he hasn't felt it necessary before. He's been so stupid before. Maybe, woman, this dream happened because the man with a vacuum cleaner is cleaning up trivial stuff. That's what the bishop is valuing now. He sees trivial stuff getting taken care of. He doesn't see the big picture. He's young, well-intended, a medical doctor, just beginning his practice. He's very confident and open and aware of being inexperienced. He's trying to do a good job, but it's all new to him. He has no idea of what's coming. Eugene, what have you heard yourself say? That my experience of the Mormon Church is that the institution is rigid and insecure, as well as unnecessarily defensive. It is self-contained and doesn't see the need for or want any outside influence. But there is a presence there within it in the form of a liberated and liberating female that is very much aware of what is and isn't true, who is there in a loving way despite the institutional self-sufficiency and spiritual conceit. The large woman part of me has been through the woods, the ravine, the wars, and survived them all, and thrived in spite of all of this, and achieved a sense of peace and wisdom and centeredness. She is good-humored and doesn't preach or attack. I'm in Los Alamos for more than just happenstance. If this were a wake-up call from the central part of you, of what you are, Eugene, what do you think it would be saying to you? I don't need to be anxious or sweat consequences. Feel humor. Be caring. Love church authorities, family, colleagues. There isn't anything other than that to concentrate on. As René Girard once said, the first fear of two fears experienced by ecclesiastical institutions is generally the fear of defilement. That's the first fear. The second is the fear of insufficient love. That is, not loving well enough. That's the fear experienced by the saints of old. If one must fear, that's the fear to embrace, not the first kind. And that's the fear that the Latter-day Saints ought to have. And just at the end of this, the last slide, 23. Believe in nothing just because a so-called wise person said it. Believe in nothing just because a belief is generally held. Believe nothing, nothing just because it is said in ancient books. Believe nothing just because it is said to be of divine origin. Believe nothing just because someone else believes it. Believe only what you yourself test and judge to be true. In conclusion, I hope I have shown how the legendary, notorious town of Los Alamos is in a unique position to send a creative ripple into the international arena to counter the destructive legacy of bomb power. Because of their rising prominence in the national discourse, Mormons as individual citizens, such as my cousin Del Clausen, can set transforming examples in their respective communities, even if the Mormon Church institution cannot tell its history straight without shame or becoming publicly aware of its practice of exercising unrighteous dominion. Such initiatives as Dialogue, Sunstone, and Mormon Stories begin with grassroots awareness inspired by these symposia and other independent agencies of enlightened groups of courageous individuals who can stand firm in obeying their personal consciences beyond the subtle and not-so-subtle institutional pressures to compromise or violate their individual consciences. Let us allow fear to control our lives and destinies, regardless the cost. Save it be the fear of not loving well enough. As a heavenly being recently said to a Mormon brother in his near-death experience before the brother was sent back to his broken body, to what degree have you learned to love? If any of you are interested to participate with us in LADOF, or have suggestions or wish to learn how to make a difference in your own community by learning transformative dreamwork methodologies as exemplified above, please contact me.
Thank you.
We haven't time for questions, but I was told I get to ask the first one, which we have not time. And so I'm simply going to say that the Chippewa Indians, with whom I lived for a year on my mission, have a tradition. And that tradition is that crazy people are in some way touched by the gods. And I believe this to be true, which is why I have always admired the friendship of the craziest man I know, which is Eugene Kovalenko. And I think that the church is much the poorer for his absence. And I think that if we were to bring him back in on a kind of an adjunct basis and replace high councilmen on high councilman Sundays with him, you can imagine how the deacons would be jolted away by his stories. Brother Kovalenko, thank you very much.